Most of us learned in the fourth grade that the American Revolution was sparked by Great Britain's decision in 1773 to tax tea. But in his new book called Defying Empire, Thomas M. Trucks explains that much of the colonists' outrage at that tax really came when they understood that the British officials were serious for the first time in years about collecting the tax. Thomas Trucks is a senior lecturer with the History Department at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. His book is published by Yale University Press, and I'm pleased that it has brought Professor Trucks to the show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Your book covers commerce and politics in New York City during the 25-year period leading up to the American Revolution. During that time, weren't the colonists, especially a powerful group of New York City merchants, able to successfully evade or ignore the import and export taxes that the British levied on their transactions?
Sure they were, before the war especially. Yeah.
And how did they do that?
Well, before the war and, well, through the war, they did it mainly by paying off customs officials, getting around the paperwork. The commercial system in the Atlantic was a pretty well-oiled machine, and it was only during the war, toward the end of the war, that merchants ran into serious problems.
So there was a lot of corruption.
There was a lot of corruption. The system was pretty much dependent on corruption, yes.
With the customs officials in New York and New Jersey actually supplying ships with false documents so that they could avoid paying the fees.
Yes, they were.
And many of New York City's leading politicians connected to the shipping industry, either as investors or through relatives, were also unwilling to do anything that would cut into their profits.
Yes, and New York was a commercial center. It was one of the great Atlantic ports of the mid-18th century. It wasn't the largest, but it was one of the most dynamic. It was a thriving place. And the political system and the commercial system were really one fabric, a single thriving commercial system.
Where would the taxes have gone? Would they have been used in this area, in the colonies, or would they have been sent back to England?
The taxes, had they been collected, would have been sent back to London through the customs service, and they would have been a source of revenue for the crown. But very few taxes were collected. Very little money actually made its way back to the crown because of the corruption in the system.
Now, you mentioned the war, the Seven Years' War.
Yes.
Which I learned was the French and Indian War,
yes.
The same war, interestingly, lasted 9 years,
yes,
didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
So why is it called the Seven-Year War?
Well, it was 9 years of fighting, but the war was declared in May of 1756 and ended in the first half of 1763. So there's 7 years of declared war and 9 years of fighting.
And not all that long before the American Revolution begins.
No, the American Revolution really begins in the wake of this war. And we can't necessarily think of a day or a month or a specific starting point to the war, but it's in the aftermath of the war.
And the seeds for the revolution really are sown at this point.
Yes, they're sown in the British reaction to what had been going on in New York and Philadelphia, Boston and elsewhere, but New York was the center.
During the period that you've written about, most New Yorkers were British subjects and were expected to fight with Britain in North America when Britain declared war on France in July 1754. Well, how willing were they to fight against the French?
Well, most New Yorkers, and especially the class we're talking about here, the commercial classes, were loyal subjects of the crown. This wasn't about disloyalty and it wasn't about a lack of patriotism. It was about the money. It was about the commercial system. They were, when recruited, they fought. There were New York companies. There were in the militia. There were New York soldiers who fought with British regulars. But the situation that developed in the city was apart from a standard of a test or a standard of loyalty or disloyalty. It was about taking advantage of markets and opportunities when they presented themselves, and they did present themselves.
Also, hadn't they long-established relationship with the French? They've been trading with the French for a long time before the war.
Yes, and especially a subgroup of merchants in New York, young Irish merchants who were a driving force in this book, were at the center of it because there had been established in the 17th century a strong Franco-Irish relationship, and that meant that there were Irish merchant houses such as the McCartys and several others with branches in Bordeaux, in Nantes, in the French West Indies, places like Cape Francois, modern Cape Haitien, in New York City, Philadelphia, and elsewhere. So there was an Irish commercial network that made it possible for New Yorkers to gently slip into the system more or less unnoticed.
Did anyone at the time question the fact that some businessmen were maximizing profits without regard to how their actions would affect the nation as a whole?
Yes, they did. And The Flying Empire opens with a prologue, the story of an informer who is severely punished for his
And we'll get
attempt.
To him.
Yes.
Terrible story.
Yes.
But I was wondering whether there was a sense of nationhood before the Declaration of Independence.
Absolutely.
So treason still would have been treason
in
their eyes.
The issue of treason is an interesting one, because at no time in this episode is any participant brought to trial on a charge of treason. Treason was a capital offense. It required proof of intent to commit treason. And so treason was not really the issue as much as, from the British point of view, technical violations of navigation laws.
The law regarding treason actually went back to 1351, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And if you read it, it said in effect that New York merchants were only considered in violation of the law if they were trading with the intent of helping the French win the war.
Yes.
But if they were giving the French food and other things, even if they weren't selling them guns, weren't they helping them?
Of course, they were helping them, but it was the burden of the state to prove intent. And there is where the problem lay.
You also say that the British sent the colonial merchants mixed signals about trading with the French. At the start of the war, the British mostly ignored the colonists' dealings with the French.
Well, at the very beginning of the war, the first year or so, there was a strong governor, provincial governor, who was a British admiral, Charles Hardy. He attempted to curb it, to bring it to a stop. But when he returned to the fleet in June of 1757, he was replaced by probably the most powerful New York politician of the colonial period, James Delancey. And Delancey was a leading figure in the commercial structure of the city. And his family was deeply involved, although his hands weren't particularly dirty. His entire family was, and their associates, and it was the fabric of the city was then drawn completely into the trading system with the enemy.
If we want to know the names of a lot of these merchants, we just simply go to the Lower East Side, Delancey Street, Eldred Street.
Yes, yes. In fact,
Rivington.
And New Yorkers walk around those streets constantly, and they look up and see the street signs and wonder who these people are. Many of the streets in Lower Manhattan are named after the leading commercial figures, and they made their money where they could make it and under what circumstances they could make it.
You mentioned earlier that New York did send soldiers to fight, but wasn't there a certain amount of friction because the British soldiers really looked down on the locals, didn't they?
Yes. Now, that issue came to bear particularly in the early part of the war when British regulars and colonial militia were fighting north of New York in what is now the north area north of Albany, Schenectady, that region. There was quite a bit of friction there. But it was later in the war that kind of friction dissipated. And we need to make the distinction between provincial New York, which is the forebear of New York State, and New York City. New York City contributed relatively few soldiers, many sailors, but relatively few soldiers to the war effort.
My guest is Thomas M. Trux, T-R-U-X-E-S, a senior lecturer in the History Department at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, also adjunct associate professor in the Irish Studies Department at New York University. His latest book is called Defying Empire, Trading with the Enemy in Colonial New York. It is published by Yale University Press. You mentioned that we supplied sailors. That's because New York really was one of the great natural ports. And at that time, that was a major source of New York's prosperity.
Yes.
We were an import-export town.
Yes. But it was also the terminus of the British North Atlantic Postal Service during the war. It was the main supply depot for all British forces in North America. It was the headquarters of the British Army. It was an important station for ships operating, warships operating on the North American coast. It was a busy, busy, thriving place.
And we would get stuff and then warehouse it and then ship it out.
Yes.
And in the case of the Seven-Year War, we had a situation where we were shipping it to both the British and the French. To the point where it was kind of hard to meet all the demands.
That's right. That's right. In fact, the crackdown on trading with the enemy, which took place in the spring of 1762, resulted from a severe shortage of supplies for the British forces. And that led General Amherst, the commander of all the British military in America, to shut the door on the entire operation. That led to jailings and trials and an uproar.
Of course, after the war, things got rough because the trade kind of dissipated, didn't
it? Yes, it did. Well, there was an economic collapse at the end of the war, which often happened and in wars in that era. But there was a great deal of money out in trading ventures that no longer could return the profits. Bankruptcies galore following the war.
We talk about the tea tax, but one of the things that exacerbated the situation came early in 1757, the Flour Act.
Yes, yes. Yes.
And what did that come
up
for?
Well, the Flour Act was one of the hidden causes of the American Revolution, this seemingly harmless law of 1757. It specified that North American shippers could send cargoes only to ports within the British system, and the penalties were absolutely severe. If you, however, were a shipper from Scotland or any of the English ports, or an Irish port, you weren't obliged to conform to the terms of the Act. So it was seen as harsh, discriminatory legislation, and those...
And arbitrary,
and led to bankruptcies, and led to a lot of bitterness.
And then later came the Sugar Act and the Currency Act.
Yes.
And these came after the end of the French and Indian War?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
And so now business was tight, and New Yorkers were expected, or the colonists in general were expected to start really paying up their taxes?
Yes, they were. The British Treasury had an enormous war debt that needed to be paid. And what's forgotten, I think, in retrospective history, was that the British expected another Anglo-French war, and they wanted to get that debt out of the way and show up for the next round because there had been a string of these wars through the century.
Let's talk about the man you mentioned earlier,
yes.
George Spencer.
Yes.
An incredible story.
Yes.
And I suspect that even though his story may have been one of the worst, there were other people who were caught in a similar bind.
Mm-hmm.
He stepped forward in 1759 when the British offered a large reward for information about illegal trading.
Yeah.
What information did he have?
Well, he had information that he had privately collected, and he had information that he had gotten from close family relatives. He was something of a double dealer. He had a nephew who was involved in supplying false papers to traders doing business with the French. And at the same time, he had gone through the docks and the ships, and he was in severely distressed financial shape and was doing whatever he could to dig himself out of a hole, and the rewards would have been huge.
He was kind of like a bounty hunter.
Of a kind, yes, yes. Self-appointed, I might add.
He wound up being found out.
Yes, because...
And that was a big problem for him.
Yes, well, he wasn't so much found out as much as he declared. He went to the Lieutenant Governor Delancey. He went to the head of the Customs Service in New York and announced that he was going to be turning people in. And within hours, the city mobilized against him.
Well, first of all, some of the people he was turning in had friends in high places.
Yes, they did.
And then there was a riot as a result of his being an informer.
Yes.
He wound up being arrested. Somebody said, well, you know, this guy owes a lot of money.
Yes.
We're going to throw him in debtor's prison.
Yes, and the charges were supported by forged documents. He, in fact, was a debtor. But he had worked out an arrangement with the court. Unfortunately, it wasn't quite enough.
But all of this led to him fearing for his life. He fled to England.
After 27 months in jail.
And did he play a role in the enactment of the notorious tax on tea?
Well, that would be up to the reader to decide. I think what we have is absolutely hard evidence that he, in fact, in the mid-1760s, in 1766, made a proposal to the British government that this would be a way to raise revenue in America. But it's years later before the tea tax was passed. But here we have the idea coming from an American, from a New Yorker.
Well, we have all these taxes, the flour tax and then the sugar tax, the Currency Act, and then later the Stamp Act, and then finally the tea tax. You could see where people started feeling that they went from not having to pay anything to paying an incredibly large amount of money.
Yes, and I think this is misunderstood fairly broadly. Because what is missed is that these merchants were highly competitive characters, trading on very close margins. So when the price structure was altered, it can drive them into bankruptcy. So what would be pennies would seem to us, looking back on it, pennies on a tax here, pennies for a tax there, could completely upend the commercial system. And that was certainly at the core of this problem.
And mostly New York, or because New York wasn't the largest city at the time.
No,
Boston and Philadelphia were.
Philadelphia was larger. Boston had become slightly smaller. New York grew quite large during the war. It began the war with about 13,000 people, ended the war with about 20,000 to 21,000 people. So it had become, it really was transformed by the war into a bigger, more thriving place.
Still, the rest of the country is largely untouched by this, isn't it?
Well, the North American ports were all Boston, Newport, New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, all had a hand in this in some way or another. But New York and Philadelphia were in it the deepest. In New York, probably the most outrageous participant.
In reading this, I wondered if you felt any sympathy for George Spencer. Was he one of America's first whistleblowers, or was he just an opportunist trying to cash in on the reward?
Well, I would think one has to be sympathetic, I think, to him because of the plight that he had gotten himself into. But
he suffered physical damage as well.
He did, but he was irrepressible. When he went back to Britain following the war, within just a few years, he was ordained as an Anglican clergyman, came back to America, to New Jersey, to take up a posting, and was run out of town, sent back packing to England.
Because people remember?
Oh, they absolutely remembered him, yes. It was all over the newspapers. In fact, when he arrived, notices were published in the paper to have nothing to do with George Spencer, the informer. He was a celebrity.
Meanwhile, the New York City businesses bounced back, didn't they?
Eventually they did, but it was a rough sledding for a decade after the war. And it's that period, the period between the end of Defying Empire and 1775. That's a decade of trouble, and the revolution would be no surprise.
And yet, as I remember my history, New York was a kind of divided city. It often was very strongly in support of the Tory cause.
It was a loyalist city during the war.
And why would that be, considering all of this?
Well, because the commercial faction, still called the Delancey faction even after his death, was much more closely tied to British authority. So they just had deeper roots into the British system than elsewhere. But it was a loyalist city, yes.
They just didn't want to pay all of those taxes.
Yes.
Thomas Trucks will be giving a talk on April 15th at 6:30 at the American-Irish Historical Society on Fifth Avenue. If you forget or you want more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org for all the details. His book, Defying Empire, Trading with the Enemy in Colonial New York, is published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.